Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
1962, Centralia, Pennsylvania. Residents of this peaceful mining town very quickly discover their lives would be changing forever as a fire broke out in the mines beneath the city, a fire that would eventually turn Centralia into an uninhabitable wasteland. The Centralia Mine Fire, today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
The Centralia Mine Fire is a coal seam fire that's been burning underneath the borough of Centralia, Pennsylvania, in the United States, since at least May 27th of 1962. Its original cause is still a matter of debate. It's burning in underground coal mines at depths of up to 300 feet over an 8-mile stretch of 37,000 acres. At its current rate, it could continue to burn for over 250 years. It's caused most of the town to be abandoned. The population dwindled from around 1,500 at the time of the fire down to 5 in 2017, and most of the buildings have been razed. On May 7th, 1962, the Centralia Council met to discuss the approaching Memorial Day and how the town would go about cleaning up the Centralia landfill, which was introduced earlier that year. The 300-foot-wide, 75-foot-long pit was made up of 50-foot-deep strip mines that had been cleared by Edward Whitney in 1935 and came very close to the northeast corner of Odd Fellows Cemetery. There were 8 illegal dumps spread about Centralia, and the council's intention in creating the landfill was to stop the illegal dumping, as new state regulations had forced the town to close an earlier dump west of St. Ignatius Cemetery. Trustees at the cemetery were opposed to the landfill's proximity to the cemetery, but recognized the illegal dumping elsewhere as a serious problem, and envisioned that the new pit would resolve it. Pennsylvania had passed a precautionary law in 1956 to regulate landfill use in strip mines, as landfills were known to cause destructive mine fires. The law required a permit and regular inspection for the municipality to use such a pit. George Segaris, a regional landfill inspector who worked for the Department of Mines and Mineral Industries, became concerned about the pit when he noticed holes in the walls and floor, such as mines often cut through older mines underneath. He informed Joseph Teague, a Centralia councilman, that the pit would require filling with an incombustible material. So that's where we'll start out today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia about the Centralia mine fire, which still burns to this day. Tony and Jenny Bruschi joining you. Be sure to press subscribe, whatever platform you are listening to The Dark Side of Wikipedia on. This is a case that's always, I mean, it's intrigued me because it's just like, really? That exists? That's real?
Yeah.
What do you know about the Centralia? It's about Centralia in general?
Nothing, honestly. Really? Other than I knew it was the town that burned down from underneath.
Well, and really, it didn't technically burn down. It is essentially became uninhabitable. I mean, there were several fires that were accredited to the mine fire, but eventually it just, there was so much smoke coming up from the ground and holes that were popping up around the city. There was one where a kid almost fell into the hole and his brother saved him and got him out, just like a well almost, but it wasn't a well. It was a hole to the mine that just gone.
Wow.
And he survived and got out. But then they just started realizing this is not safe to be around anymore. These houses can't be here. And the carbon, what would it be? Carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide? I always get the two mixed up.
Either one is bad for you.
Coming out of the ground was also obviously super toxic. So they actually tore down their city.
Just so nobody would stay.
There's like five people. I don't know how many people are there today, but as of 2017, there were five.
You got to wonder why. Or what the thinking is behind the five people staying.
Like, I don't know.
Why would they risk it?
It's interesting because it was just, you know, it was your normal, you know, you see old videos of it. And it's just this little, you know, it's a mod. Don't think like mining town of like days of yore. You know, it's not cowboy mining town. This is 1960s mining town. Mm-hmm. So it's very, you know, modern, you know, if you will. I mean, and it looked like a 1960s town, you know, and then just, you know, it stopped. You couldn't live there anymore. And we'll go through what kind of happened with the city, but it was the inspiration for a video game that I used to play. And then it became a movie called Silent Hill, which in Silent Hill, you're running around this town that's completely abandoned and there's like these demon-like creatures, but it's all this fog that's coming up from the ground and then the edges of the town are all gone, which is pretty much like what Centralia is.
Yeah.
And I mean, great movie or a great inspiration point, but I can't imagine just like your hometown. Sorry. You can't live there anymore. You can technically visit it. There's a lot of tourism that goes there now, but it's like the same type of tourism that visits like Chernobyl. Mm-hmm. let's continue on with the story of Centralia. The town council arranged for cleanup of the strip mine dump, but council minutes do not describe the proposed procedure. DeCock surmises that the process, setting it on fire, was not specified because state law prohibited dump fires. Nonetheless, the Centralia Council set a date and hired five members of the volunteer company to clean up the landfill. This meant starting a fire. A fire was ignited to clean the dump on May 27, 1962, and water was used to douse the visible flames that night. However, flames were seen once more on May 29th. Using hoses hooked up from Locust Avenue, another attempt was made to douse the fire that night. Another flare-up the following week, June 4th, caused the Centralia Fire Company to once again douse it with hoses. A bulldozer stirred up the garbage so that firemen could douse concealed layers of the burning waste. A few days later, a hole as wide as 15 feet and several feet high was found at the base of the north wall of the pit. Garbage had concealed the hole and prevented it from being filled with incombustible material. It's possible that this hole led to the mine fire, as it provided a pathway to the labyrinth of old mines under the borough. Evidence indicates that despite these efforts to douse the fire, the landfill continued to burn. On July 9th, Monsignor William J. Burke complained about foul odors from the smoldering trash and coal reaching St. Ignatius Church. Even then, the Centralia City Council still allowed the dumping of garbage into the pit. A member of the council contacted Clarence Kashner, the president of the Independent Miners, Breakersmen, and Truckers Union, to inspect the situation in Centralia. Kashner evaluated the events and called Gordon Smith, an engineer at the Department of Mines and Mineral Industries, and the office in Pottsville. Smith told the town that he could dig out the smoldering material using a steam shovel for $175. A call was placed to Art Joyce, a mine inspector in Mount Carmel, who brought gas detection equipment for use on the swirling wisps of smoke now emanating from fissures in the north wall of the landfill pit. Tests concluded that the gases seeping from the large hole in the pit wall and from the cracks in the north wall contained carbon monoxide, typical of coal mine fires. The Centralia Council sent a letter to the Lee Valley Coal Company as formal notice of the fire. It is speculated that the town council decided that hiding the true origin of the fire would serve better than alerting the LVCC of the truth, which would most likely end in receiving no help from them. In the letter, the borough described the starting of the fire as of unknown origin during a period of unusually hot weather, preceding an August 6 meeting at the fire site, which would include officials from the LVCC and the Susquehanna Coal Company. Deputy Secretary of Mines James Schober Sr. expected that the representatives would inform him they could not afford mounting a project that would stop the mine fire. Therefore, Schober announced that he expected the state to finance the cost of digging out the fire, which was at that time around $30,000. Another offer was made at the meeting, proposed by Centralia strip mine operator Alonzo Sanchez, who told members of the council that he would dig out the mine fire free of charge as long as he could claim any coal he recovered without paying royalties to the Lee Valley Coal Company. Part of Sanchez's plan was to do exploratory drilling to estimate the scope of the mine fire, which was most likely why Sanchez's offer was rejected at the meeting. The drilling would have delayed the project, not to mention the legal problems with mining rights. At the time, state mine inspectors were in the Centralia area mines almost daily to check for lethal levels of carbon monoxide. Lethal levels were found on August 9th, and all Centralia area mines were closed the next day. Early remediation attempts, first excavation project, pressed at an August 12th meeting of the United Mine Workers of America. In Centralia, Secretary of Mines Lewis Evans sent a letter to the group on August 15th that claimed he had authorized a project to deal with the mine fire and that bids for the project would be opened on August 17th. 2 days later, the contract was awarded to Birdie Inc., a company near Mount Carmel, for an estimated $20,000. Work on the project began August 22nd. The Department of Mines and Mineral Industries, who originally believed Birdie would need only to excavate 24,000 cubic yards of earth, informed them that they were forbidden from doing any exploratory drilling in order to find the perimeter of the fire or how deep it was, and that they were strictly to follow plans drawn up by the engineers, who did not believe that the fire was very big or active. The size of the location of the fire were instead estimated based on the amount of steam issuing from the landfill rock. Birdie, following the engineering team plan, began by digging on the northern perimeter of the dump pit rim and excavated about 200 feet outward to expand the perimeter. However, the project was ultimately ineffective due to multiple factors. Intentional breaching of the subterranean mine chambers allowed large amounts of oxygen to rush in, greatly worsening the fire. Steve Casilla, a bulldozer operator in Birdie's project, said that the project was ineffective because the inrush of air helped the fire to move ahead of the excavation point by the time the section was drilled and blasted. Birdie was also using a 2.5 cubic yard shovel, which was considered small for the project. Furthermore, the state only permitted Birdie's team to work weekday shifts, which were 8 hours long and only occurred during the daytime, commonly referred to as first shift in the mining industry. At one point, work was at standstill for 5 days during the Labor Day weekend in early September. Finally, the fire was traveling in a northward direction, which caused the fire to move deeper into the coal seam. Thus, combined with the work restrictions and inadequate equipment,
greatly increased the excavation cost. Bertie had excavated 58,580 cubic yards of earth by the time the project ran out of money and ended on October 29th, 1962.
So it sounds like a massive cover your ass operation at this point.
Yeah.
Everybody's trying to do anything they can to not get, you know, blamed for what's going on.
Yeah. It's only do this over here. Only do that over here. And don't look under that rock because that might reveal that something I didn't tell you about.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like there was a possibility early on. If they would have looked at this more as an environmental crisis rather than a whodunit.
Yeah.
Because the whodunit, I don't think they realized that there would be no end to this, that there was a very strict timetable in extinguishing this fire.
Well, and the cost of having put incombustible materials in there in the first place to block the fire from spreading to the mine is a, you know, a fraction of what it ended up being to try and just even explore the extent of the fire, let alone losing the entire town.
It's really like it's a lesson in do it the right way or don't do it at all.
Exactly.
It can almost be a cautionary tale for cautionary tales of Harper. Don't start a mine fire. Don't put a dump on top of an old mine just in case you ever want to. But no, I mean, it is. I mean, there's so much to this story. And to this day, it is argued as to what started it. There are people who will still say it wasn't the dump fire, that it was something else. It was somebody else that dumped something over there.
Well, does it matter at this point?
No.
The town's on fire and it's going to be burning for 250 more years, probably.
What's funny to me is how they're like literally like, okay, we're going to open up bidding for this project on the 17th. It's like, it's like having like a large skyscraper burning and going, okay, let's bid to see who wants to put the fire out.
Yeah.
You want to be this fire station A or fight? Like, that is one of those things where it's like, okay, you know, there's a lot of things that I think private industry can do better than government. Things like this, like fire and police and that sort of stuff, you don't want that because that's what would happen.
You don't want the lowest bidder. Otherwise, you end up with this.
Yes, you would have something like this happening in all aspects of life.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be like, oh, you want us to? Well, I'm sorry. You didn't renew your fire subscription plan. You know, like sometimes in the mail.
Yeah.
Here's a great example of it, of how private industry has taken over and something in the medical industry that I think is just fucked in the head. The helicopter rescue stuff.
Yeah. If you have a sticker on your car, does that mean you're more likely to get rescued by a helicopter and taken to a hospital in a timely manner than just a regular person?
They will use that. I mean, and it all depends on the helicopter company.
Uh-huh.
Some are shady, some are not.
Okay.
But they're, a lot of them are private contractors. They're not owned by the hospital. And if your insurance does not cover helicopter rescue, but you need a helicopter, you'll get on a helicopter. It's not going to be like, oh, their insurance doesn't cover helicopters, so we're just going to take the ambulance route.
Right.
If the paramedics deem this is a helicopter rescue needed, you're getting a helicopter. At the end of that day, you may end up with an $80,000 helicopter bill, which your insurance doesn't cover. And guess what? Now you're indebted $80,000 to the helicopter company, and there's no way around that shithole. But now what they try and do is you'll get mailers that say, you don't want to be caught in the case of an emergency and you get this helicopter bill. You don't want that. So pay us $30 a month or whatever the hell it is, and then you're covered. And it's just if that helicopter company happens to be the helicopter company that's used and called for your rescue. If it's the other one that you don't have the insurance through, you're fucked.
So, yeah, because they're not going to take the time to walk around your car and see if you have one of those helicopter stickers to make sure they call the right company.
No. It should just be one of those, because it's the right thing to do, that this exists, that this is something that is covered by insurances.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or just the same reason that you don't necessarily get a bill, at least as far as I know. The police don't bill you when they come to your house. You don't get necessarily a... Do you get a bill? You probably do get a bill from paramedics, wouldn't you?
I think if they have to...
If it's not a firefight.
Yeah, if they have to treat you, then yes.
Once it gets to, like, the medical company paramedics, yes. But I don't believe if firefighters came as paramedically trained, they don't bill you. You don't get a bill when the fire department puts out your house if right. your house is on fire.
Right.
But you would get a bill with a helicopter.
Yeah.
So that to me is one of those things where it's like, this just doesn't seem right the way the system is set up.
Is it because, and this is going to be really morbid, but we talk about a lot of morbid things. Mm-hmm. Is it because if you were in such bad shape that you need to be life-flighted,
mm-hmm.
that they don't want to cover the bills of your hospital stay because you're going to be, if you survive, there probably for an extensive amount of time? Is that why they don't cover the helicopter flight?
No, I don't know what the reasoning is other than it's expensive. And it can be one of those things where does that helicopter flight legitimately cost as much as they're charging?
Well, it may, because you've got all the expenses of just a helicopter flight, which is expensive.
Yeah.
Plus, then you have a team of medical staff on there.
Yeah.
You know, and it depends on how far they have to fly. If they have to fly you, most of the time it's you're not going to make it if we put you in an ambulance. So it's a distance.
I just didn't know if it was one of those things where, like, okay, obviously it will be expensive, but is it as expensive as what they're trying to charge the individual or trying to charge an insurance company? And the insurance companies eventually just said, no, we're not going to pay that much for this service. Here's what we will cover. Like they do to hospitals where it's like, you know, we're not going to cover an $80 aspirin, but we will cover it at $50 where they negotiate out prices. Like that's how it works. I'm wondering if something happened with the helicopter world and that's where it got to be like that, or it's just, they just said, fuck it at some point. I don't know. Or if some law changed and it just said, you don't have to cover this anymore.
Well, I just had always wondered about the stickers on the cars, you know, if it was the same thought process as the people who support the law enforcement, you know, and they get the sticker and they put the sticker on the car.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, I'm not saying anything good or bad about law enforcement, but the people that believe that if they have that sticker on the car, they won't get pulled over.
Yeah. Or like, you're less likely to be pulled over with a sticker.
If you're breaking the law, you're going to get pulled over, sticker or not.
Exactly.
So I just wondered, you know, what the thought process was behind the life flight.
Well, it makes me wonder. I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's just a matter of billing and if you have that coverage or not. And then if it's the right helicopter, I don't think anybody's going through in the emergency as it's like you're about to die. Let me go check the back of their Pinto over there and see if they got the sticker. Oh, OK, we can call the helicopter, but it has to be this one. You know,
right.
It's just to me, it's like, I don't think this is how this, I don't know. It seems like a good money making scheme. You know, where in some cases it works okay, in some cases not so much. Anyway. Back to Burning Towns. Here on the dark side of Wikipedia, as we continue the story of Centralia. The second excavation project on October 29th, just prior to the termination of the Birdie Project, a new proposed project that involved flushing the mine fire. Crushed rock would be mixed with water and pumped into Centralia's mines ahead of the expected fire expansion. The project was estimated to cost roughly $40,000. Bids were open on November 1st, and the project was awarded to K&H Excavating with a low bid of $28,400. Drilling was conducted through holes spaced 20 feet apart in a semicircular pattern along the edge of the landfill. However, this project was also ineffective due to multiple factors. Centralia experienced an unusually heavy period of snowfall and unseasonably low temperatures during the project. Winter weather caused water supply lines to freeze. Furthermore, the rock grinding machine froze during the windy blizzard. Both problems inhibited timely mixture and administration of the crushed rock slurry. The DMMI also worried that the 10,000 cubic yards of flushing material would not be enough to fill the mines, thus preventing the boreholes from filling completely. partially filled boreholes would provide an escape route for the fire, rendering the project ineffective. These problems quickly depleted funds. In response, Secretary Evans approved an additional $14,000 to fund the project. Funding for the project ran out on March 15, 1963, with a total cost of $42,420. On April 11th, steam issuing from additional openings in the ground indicated that the fire had spread eastward as far as 700 feet and that the project had failed. A third option proposal was drawn up soon after that, although the project would be delayed until after the new fiscal year beginning July 1, 1963. The first option, costing $277,490, consisted of entrenching the fire and backfilling the trench with incombustible material. The second, costing $151,714, offered a smaller trench in an incomplete circle, followed by the completion of the circle with a flush barrier. The third plan was a total and concerted flushing project, larger than the second project's flushing and costing $82,300. The state abandoned this project in 1963. Later remediation projects. David DeCook began reporting on the mine fire for the new news item in Samakan beginning in late 1976. Between 1976 and 1986, he wrote over 500 articles about the mine fire. In 1979, locals became aware of the scale of the problem when a gas station owner, then Mayor John Coddington, inserted a dipstick into one of his underground tanks to check the fuel level. When he withdrew it, it seemed hot. He lowered a thermometer into the tank on a string and was shocked to discover that the temperature of the gasoline in the tank was 172 degrees Fahrenheit. Beginning in 1980, adverse health effects were reported by several people due to the byproducts of the fire: carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and low oxygen levels. Statewide attention to the fire began to increase, culminating in 1981, when a 12-year-old resident named Todd fell into a sinkhole 4 feet wide by 150 feet deep that suddenly opened beneath his feet in a backyard. He clung to a tree root until his cousin, 14-year-old Eric Wolfgang, saved his life by pulling him out of the hole. The plume of hot steam billowing from the hole was measured as containing a lethal level of carbon monoxide. A number of competing hypotheses have arisen about the source of the Centralia mine fire. Some of them claim that the mine fire started before May 27, 1962. David DeCock says that the borough's deliberate burning of trash on May 27th to clean up a landfill in the former strip mine ignited a coal seam via an unsealed opening in the trash pit, which allowed the fire to enter the labyrinth of abandoned coal mines beneath Centralia. John Quigley argues in her 2007 book, The Day the Earth Caved In, that the fire had in fact started the previous day when a trash hauler dumped hot ash or coal discarded from coal burners into the open trash pit. She noted that borough council minutes on June 4, 1962 referred to two fires at the dump and that five firefighters had submitted bills for fighting the fires at the landfill area. The borough by law was responsible for installing a fire-resistant clay barrier between each layer of trash in the landfill, but fell behind schedule, leaving the barrier incomplete. This allowed the hot coals to penetrate the vein of coal underneath the pit and light the subsequent subterranean fire. In addition to the council minutes, Quigley cites interviews with volunteer firemen, the former fire chief, borough officials, and several eyewitnesses as her sources. Another hypothesis is known as the BAST theory. It states that the fire was burning long before the alleged trash dump fire. According to local legend, the BAST Colliery coal fire of 1932, set alight by an explosion, was never fully extinguished. In 1962, it reached the landfill area. Those who adhere to the blast theory believe that the dump fire is a separate fire unrelated to the Centralia mine fire. One man who disagrees is Frank Jurgel Sr., who claims he operated the bootleg mine with his brother in the vicinity of the landfill between 1960 and 1962. He says that if the BAST colliery fire had never been put out, he and his brother would have been in it and killed by the gases. Based on this and due to contrary evidence, few hold this position and is given little credibility. Centralia Councilman Joseph Teague proposed a different hypothesis that Centralia's coal fire was actually started by an adjacent coal seam fire that had been burning of West Centralia's. His belief is that the adjacent fire was at one time partially excavated, but it nonetheless set alight the landfill on May 27th. Another hypothesis arose from a letter sent to the Lee Valley Coal Company by the Centralia Council in the days after the mine fire was noticed. The letter describes a fire of unknown origin on or about June 25th, 1962, during a period of unusually hot weather. This may make a reference to the hypothesis of spontaneous combustion being the reason for the start of the landfill fire, a hypothesis accepted for many years by state and federal officials. In 1984, Congress allocated more than $42 million for relocation efforts. Most of the residents accepted buyout offers and dispersed far away from the area. Data from the 1990 United States Census shows that the nearby towns continued to lose population at the same rate as previous decades, suggesting that Centralians did not locate there. A few families opted to stay despite urging from Pennsylvania officials. In 1992, Pennsylvania Governor Bob Casey invoked eminent domain on all properties in the borough, condemning all the buildings within. A subsequent legal effort by residents to have the decision reversed failed. In 2002, the U.S. Postal Service revoked Centralia's zip code of 17927. In 2009, Governor Ed Riddell began the formal eviction of Centralia residents. In July of 2012, the last handful of residents of Centralia lost their appeal of a court decision upholding eminent domain proceedings and were ordered again to leave. State and local officials reached an agreement with seven remaining residents on October 29th of 2013, allowing them to live out their lives there, after which the rights of their properties will be taken through eminent domain. The Centralia mine fire also extended beneath the town of Burnsville, a few miles to the south. The town had to be abandoned and leveled. The Centralia area has now grown to be a tourist attraction. Visitors come to see the smoke on Centralia's empty streets and the abandoned portion of PA Route 61, properly referred to as the Graffiti Highway. As of April 2020, efforts began to cover up Graffiti Highway by a private owner of the road. The fire and its effects were featured in 2013 on America Declassified on the Travel Channel and on Radiolab's Cities episode. And now on the dark side of Wikipedia.
I kind of wonder if it wasn't a mining accident and they thought, hey, we know this is going to be bad. Let's try and make it look like it was just a municipality? Yeah, accident. By, hey, let's clean up the town. Let's support them in having this landfill fire.
Meaning like it happened a lot earlier?
Like they knew that it wasn't going to go out. And so they tried to pass the buck and make it look like this was caused by this landfill fire. And then it wasn't on them to fix it. It was on the city to try and figure it out.
That's a conspiracy theory.
It is a conspiracy theory. I have any information at all. I'm just guessing because I like to think the worst of things, and that would be one of them.
I think all of it is, I mean, everybody who, one, somebody's to blame here. And it may be a combination of things. Mm-hmm. It may be that dump truck or whatever did dump the ash there. They certainly did start the fire there. That's without question that a fire was started at the dump. Maybe the two of them in combination created enough heat for this thing to get in there. Maybe it was just one or the other. Maybe we'll never know the true answer. But what we do know is that nobody wants to take responsibility for the possibility that it was them.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to say, no, it was somebody else. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a conspiracy theory about somebody else, and they believe it's somebody else that did it. But clearly, one is to blame, or maybe a combination is to blame for it. And we'll never know the answer.
So what is fascinating, though, is that to date, at least according to this, there hasn't been any deaths related to it.
Not directly like I burned alive in the mine fire or I fell through the hole.
But health reasons later on.
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily tracked, but the carbon monoxide, mm-hmm. carbon dioxide and all that. I believe there are some that can trace it back.
Okay.
I don't believe it will medically be recognized that way, but, you know.
Yeah.
It's like the same way sometimes they can look at things and go, oh, you have emphysema and you worked in an asbestos plant most of your life. You know.
Mesothelioma.
Was that like very likely, mm-hmm. but we can't 100% conclusively say.
Yeah.
Because then you can say, well, the person over here has it, but they never worked there. It's like, yeah, well, there's like 50 that worked in the asbestos plant and one over here that didn't. So it's kind of one of those cases. But if I'm ever in that part of the country, I want to go there.
Really?
I want to see it. Yeah. I'd be so curious to walk around there and take pictures.
I'd be terrified to fall in a hole.
Yeah. You kind of wonder about that.
It could happen at any second.
You just boom. Mm-hmm. That's why you go in groups.
Why?
Because then at least some of you make it out.
Oh, Jesus.
It's kind of a dark way of looking at it.
Yeah.
It's like playing the game Lemmings on the computer as a kid. You ever play Lemmings?
Yeah, I did. And yeah. That was boring as shit you just watch people jump off a cliff.
No, you never.
They were like little creatures and they just followed each other off the cliff.
I have it on my phone.
Oh,
they just re-released it. No, you had to like give them commands to do things like put an umbrella so they floated down. It was a puzzle game.
Well, I guess I didn't catch that part. It was just the little critters going off a cliff. And I was like, what's the point of this game?
Well, here we go. Jenny's learning something new on the show. A new realization. We've had a realization on the other show that your ghost imaginary friend was not imaginary. And now I'm teaching you how to play Lemmings.
I don't want to learn how to play
30
Lemmings.
30 years later.
I just want them to just fall off the cliff.
It was fun to do that. And there was another button where you could have them all blow up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I knew none of this. I just...
It was a strategy. It was a puzzle. You'd probably like it because it's a strategy puzzle game. You have to figure out how to get them from the door that they come out of to the out. And there's, you know, they go through a series of caves and tunnels and obstacles, but they do different abilities, like build stairs or have an umbrella so they don't die when they fall down. And then you have so many things you can put these powers on them to do. And then you have to save so many of them. And there's a mass of them. And you want to get like, you know, 90-some% of them saved. Mm-hmm. But you have like 5% loss rate that you can do and still beat the level. So that's my point of Lemmings. Of
sounds like the coronavirus.
Bring them in Lemmings. Exactly. It's horrible. But it's an odds thing. And I'm kidding. I wouldn't like to take a group of people there like, well, maybe four of us, five will make it, you know, but yeah. That's kind of what it's like.
You want to visit a lot of these places, you know?
I do.
And there's a lot of things that still scare me about some of these, but like, I'm never going to go to Chernobyl.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to go to Chernobyl. I'm extremely fascinated with Chernobyl, mm-hmm. and I think it'd be really interesting to see it, but I do not trust essentially the Russian government or whoever is in control of that area right now and the tourism area of it to be truly, oh, it's okay. It's okay. It's more like people are interested. We'll make some money and go in there because you have your radar or not your radar, but your whatever the radiation levels that you check. And some of it's pretty freaking high. Like, you still shouldn't be exposed to that much radiation.
Right.
So it's not worth it to me to increase my odds of getting cancer for a one-hour trip to Chernobyl.
No.
But I am interested in going to non-radioactive abandoned places. That's right up my alley. And I feel okay about going to Centralia carefully.
Well, you do that. You just have fun in Pennsylvania because I'm not going there and I'm not going to Gettysburg and I'm not going to a lot of places because there's like scary shit in Pennsylvania. Sorry.
Centralia, Gettysburg. We have a horrible battlefield miles from our house.
But it's different.
Where thousands of people died. How does it I mean, it's a different location. More people died in Gettysburg, yes, but still, we're talking pretty damn close to the amount of people that died on 9/11 who died in a field a couple miles away.
It's different.
How?
everybody knows Gettysburg is haunted. There's not as many stories, or hardly any stories, of that battlefield being haunted.
There's a lot of stories of this battlefield being haunted. Well, you just haven't heard them yet.
It's different.
Is that opinion going to change once you've heard more stories about the battlefield,
guys? It's different.
And we'll leave it at that.
Okay.
That wraps up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Be sure to press subscribe, whatever platform it is you listen to us on. Let your friends know that we exist as well. Until next time, for all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.